This debate between the candidates in Southern Illinois' 12th Congressional District is brought to you by WSIU Public Broadcasting, the Southern Illinois and the Belleville News Democrat. It was recorded before a live audience on October 8th at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center.
Good evening from the Marion Cultural and Civic Center in Marion, Illinois. Welcome to the first of two formal broadcast debates by the three candidates running for Congress in the Illinois 12th U.S. House Districts. The candidates are State Representative Mike Boss, Republican of Murfreesboro, Green Party candidate Paula Bradshaw of Carbondale, and incumbent U.S. Representative Bill Enyart, Democrat of Belleville. The candidates will be questioned by Molly Parker of the Southern Illinois newspaper, Jennifer Fuller of WSIU Radio, and Beth Hensdorfer of the Belleville News Democrat. I'm Jack Titchener. I'll be your moderator tonight. We'll begin with a two-minute opening statement from each of the candidates, the order of which was determined by a drawing before the debate. Representative Bost will have the first opening statement.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you to the Southern Illinoisan, to the Belleville News Democrat, and for WSIU for putting on this debate. I look forward to actually talking about the issues, presenting our opinions and our views. You know, whenever it came time to decide whether or not I was going to run for this office, it was a tough decision. My family and I sat down to talk it out. But a lot of people have asked, why are you looking to do that? Well, folks, I've got 9 grandchildren. And it is not, this country's not headed in the right direction for them to have the future that they need. Whether it's jobs here in Southern Illinois, the dangers that are going on overseas, our borders are out of control. I feel it's my responsibility as their grandfather to work for them and you to try to make it better. That's what I'm asking to do. I've been out meeting with the people, talking about the issues, realizing the problems and concerns. With my past experience, believe me, I've heard plenty. And there are problems and there are things that need to be done. But let me tell you that this job is a servant's job. It's a servant's job. And the person that holds it needs to remember that you keep in constant contact with your constituency. And you do that by attending meetings, by having town hall meetings, and by just being a good servant. I look forward to tonight's debate. I look forward to the opportunity to answer many questions that I believe that will be asked here tonight. And thank you again.
Representative Enyart.
Thank you, Jack. And I also would like to thank the sponsors this evening, including the Belleville News Democrat, the Southern, and, of course, WSIU. I'd also like to thank the League of Women Voters for sponsoring this. And, you know, I'd also like to thank my opponents this evening. Paula, I'd like to thank you for your many years of service in the medical profession as an emergency room nurse. Kudos for a great career as an emergency room nurse. Thank you for that. And Mike, congratulations to you. Thank you for your 20 years or nearly 20 years of serving as a state legislator in Springfield. You know, when I was asked to run for Congress 2 years ago, I left a job that I loved as the commander of the National Guard, as a major general, to take this on. And I very early learned that I was walking in the footsteps of giants. I was walking in the footsteps of legislators like Paul Simon, like Glenn Pichard, like Kenny Gray, like Jerry Costello. Southern Illinois expects leadership like that. Southern Illinois expects statesmen like that. So it's been a learning experience for me to walk in those footsteps. You know, as a politician, it's awfully easy to make promises. So what I'm going to ask you to do tonight is examine the promises and then look to performance. I've been endorsed by the Illinois Farm Bureau because I promised I would support agriculture, and I've done so. I was part of the successful adoption of a farm bill, the first time since 2007. I promised that I would support our coal industry. I've been endorsed, and of the three candidates before you today, I'm the only one who has the endorsement of the United Mine Workers of America because I have followed through on that promise. I promise to support veterans, and I've followed through on that promise. Thank you,
Paula Bradshaw.
Hello, and also thank you to everyone who put this debate on. Right now in Hong Kong, there are thousands of people out on the streets because they want to bring more democracy to their country. They're tired of having their candidates picked for them by the government. Well, we have the same problem in this country. It's very hard for third-party candidates to get on the ballot. And if you do get on the ballot, I'm just warning the people in Hong Kong, they'll probably tell you, you can't win. The big money, they don't want you to win, so you should, why should I waste my vote voting for you? You're just a spoiler. You might even cause Kang to lose the election. Our people here, our candidates here, they aren't picked by the government. They're picked by big money. As Dick Durbin once said, let's face it, the banks own this place. Well, I call for a sales tax on Wall Street, speculation, to help raise money. I call for a progressive income tax, more progressive income tax. And I call for a publicly owned, non-debt-based source of money supply so that we can balance our budget and pay for needed services. So the banks, they aren't going to own me. Big oil and gas and the military-industrial complex also exert an unwarranted influence on Congress, as Eisenhower pointed out. We call for renewable energy and an end to the trillions of dollars spent on aggressive wars overseas. So they're not going to like me either. We call for full employment, as the Humphrey-Hawkins Act of 1978 calls for, so that people aren't forced to work for poverty wages at big box stores and fast food places. They aren't going to buy me either. I'm Paula Bradshaw, and big money doesn't approve of my message.
Okay, thank you very much. It's time for questions from the panelists. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to answer the question. The first question comes from Molly Parker for Representative Bost.
Representative Bost, we're going to start with international policy. Global terrorism has changed in that it now crosses national borders and is based more in regions and based on religious ideology. One of the most dangerous groups include ISIL, based in Syria and northern Iraq. Former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta stated recently that he believed that the U.S. should have armed Syrian moderates early on, but the plan was rejected by President Obama. Tell us, what are your thoughts on combating terrorism? Are airstrikes enough, or do we need boots on the ground?
Let me explain to you that I wish that we could go back, and I'm sure we all do, and that there would have been troops that would have been at least left as a police force to not have those young men and women who shed their blood shed their blood in vain. But let me also tell you that as I believe airstrikes are one path right now, as an elected congressman, we would have to look over each situation and make a decision. Now, let me also explain this. As a Marine, I come from a side that I understand military force and why it's necessary and why it's important to have a force in readiness, ready to handle this. But I also come as a Marine father. And the day that my son left for Iraq was probably one of the worst days I've ever felt in my life. And that is because I would have gladly, when he walked down that, through that airport, went in his place. But I didn't have that choice. But in this job, you will have the choice to understand that everybody that might be sent when you make those decisions is being sent, and they are someone's child, whether a son or a daughter. So we do need to make sure that we keep it under control, that those battles occur not on our soil, that we must make it safe. We've got to be very careful on which way we handle that.
Ms. Bradshaw.
For 13 years, we've given up liberties. We've given up trillions. We've gone trillions of dollars in debt. We've killed over a million people around the world, and now 13 years later, they tell us we're still not safe, we're spied upon, our emails are collected, our phone calls are collected, and we're still not safe. Well, let me tell you what, give me back my freedom. If the NSA that's collecting phone calls on everyone in the world couldn't figure out that 20,000 jihadists were going to cross the border, then what good are they? What good are they? What good was it spending all that money and all those lives if we're still not safe? I say give me back my freedom and stop the wars. As far as Syrian moderate rebels, That is obviously a misnomer. Anyone that's killing people is not a moderate. There are Syrian moderates, and they are like the Green Party in Syria. They are working through the political process to try to change their country. They have a parliament in Syria, and some of them have been elected. That is a political moderate. A person that's cutting off heads and slitting throats is not a moderate, and the United States should quit funding them, quit giving them arms. Syria was almost... For 3 years, the United States has been helping to back these so-called moderate... Well, first they called them peaceful protesters. Even when there were 600 dead soldiers and policemen, they were still calling them peaceful protesters. Then they switched to moderate rebels. Now we're told that the moderate rebels gave the arms to ISIS. So what's the solution? Give more arms to the moderate rebels? I don't understand the thought process here. The best thing we could do is quit funding the rebels... The jihadists is what they are, and tell our friends Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, Jordan, and the rest of them, the UAE, they also need to quit funding those jihadists, and Syria could take care of them. They almost were winning.
Thank you.
And now they're not.
Representative Inyard.
Thank you, Jack. You know, the last 5 years of my military career, I spent as the commander of the Illinois National Guard, and it was my duty to train, equip, and order our young men and women into combat. So I take these duties very seriously, and that's one of the reasons I sit on the House Armed Services Committee, because as the only serving Major General and retired Major General in Congress, I think I have a certain expertise that no one else in Congress has. We tend to look for immediate solutions, and I think what we need to do is remember the history. Take a look at the Old Testament. These wars, this butchery has been going on in the Middle East, not for generations, not for centuries, but for thousands of years. So we can't expect to fix that next week or next year or in 10 years. It's a long-term problem. It's a long-term solution. We cannot have terrorists controlling large swaths of territory through the Middle East and exporting that terror to our shores or butchering our citizens who might happen to be there. It's interesting because 1 year ago, 14 months ago, over the Labor Day weekend, I flew back to Washington, D.C., left a parade to fly to Washington, D.C. to take a classified briefing on Syria. Syria was the hot topic. The president was talking about going in then. The American people were adamantly opposed. He listened to the American people and did not go in. Today, the mood of the public has changed. And I think, though, before we put any boots on the ground, the local nations, and I'm glad to see the Arab League stepping up helping in this problem and controlling terrorists, those local nations will have to put their boots on the ground. But I think we're going to have to provide the air support. We're going to have to provide the intelligence and the logistics support to help them curtail these terrorists. Thank you.
Next question is from Jennifer Fuller for Paula Bradshaw.
Ms. Bradshaw, it was reported today that Thomas Eric Duncan, the patient who was being treated for Ebola in an isolation unit at a Texas hospital, has died. That marks the first person to die from that disease in the United States. Is the U.S. government doing enough to protect Americans from Ebola? Should the government ban flights from West Africa to this country until the disease has been brought under control? And what more would you propose to ensure the safety of American citizens here at home?
Yes, that should be a no-brainer. If you've got a virus killing people and you want to stop the spread, then you quit letting people fly from one country to the other. As far as this guy that came from, I believe it was Liberia, and brought the virus with him, they've done what the proper public health response is. They put the family under quarantine. When I was 4 years old, I got the measles, and the public health department came out and slapped a yellow sign on the door of our house, and it said we were under quarantine. And that's how they dealt with it back then, and that's how we should deal with it now. No one was allowed to come into my house, and I wasn't allowed to leave until the measles were gone, and then they took the yellow sign off, and that's how you deal with it. As far as putting the people in Liberia, here's the problem. Nigeria has got this disease under control, but Liberia just had this horrific civil war, which destroyed their public health system. You have to have a strong public health system to have public health. So, you know, they should do in Liberia and Sierra Leone what they did in Nigeria, and just, you know, you quarantine people. You don't drag them all away across town. And the problem was apparently that the people in the house wanted to go out and go shopping because they needed food. Well, the proper thing to do would be what they're doing in Texas, is take the food to the door of the house. And if the United States wants to help with that, with giving food for these people, then I can see that. But the ridiculousness of sending troops to fight a virus, I thought it was ridiculous when they wanted to go send troops to stamp out evil. But now they want to send troops to stamp out a virus. I mean, it's really ridiculous.
Representative Inyart.
Thank you, Jack. You know, the Ebola virus, I was asked about this by a reporter about a week and a half ago. And the reporter said, well, what about this humanitarian crisis? I told the reporter, the Ebola virus is not a humanitarian crisis. It is really a national security crisis. The Ebola virus is incredibly dangerous. We have to immediately swing into action to, as Paula said, essentially quarantine this. We have to get this problem solved because the rapidity with which it has spread is frightening. And the fatality rates range as high as 90%+. This is a disease that is incredibly dangerous. Currently, it is a disease that's borne by bodily fluids. But if that would make the jump to becoming an airborne disease, the rapidity with which that could spread around the world is incredibly frightening. You know, I think that this goes to show, and the Ebola virus has been around for years. We have known about the Ebola virus for years, but we've always managed to curtail it, and it's not made the leaps that it's beginning to make today. So I think that we have lagged behind in research. We need to ensure that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is properly funded and has the resources necessary to help fight this. We need to be doing the medical research and development. And unfortunately, my opponent, Mr. Bost, has endorsed the Paul Ryan budget, which slashes funding for the CDC, slashes funding for research and development. So I think Mr. Bost owes an explanation to the citizens as to why he wants to slash medical research and development, slash the budget of the Center for Disease Control, when we have viruses like the Ebola virus running rampant in our world. I have the red card, so thank you.
Representative Bost.
In the words of Ronald Reagan, there you go again. You did the same thing to Jason Plummer, but you're not going to do it to me. I never said I supported the Ryan's budget, and that is a lie. Now, back to the question. Let me tell you that is a issue that I have been very much paying attention to. My brother-in-law is a missionary that just came home. Thank heaven, everything checked out with he, his wife, and his daughters. But as Paula mentioned, the real problem is that you have one country in Liberia that the Center for Disease Control does need to be involved with, so to try to fight this there. But yes, the president has the power to control our borders and to stop the influx of anyone from those countries. I believe that should be done. But once again, I never supported the Paul Ryan budget, by the way.
Next question is from Beth Hunsdorfer for Representative Inyart.
This question comes from Belleville News Democrat reader Ms. Cheryl Matthews. Students and parents are learning a new way to learn all over the country with the implementation of Common Core standards. As the debate over whether this new system will help bridge the gap between students in American schools, many are wondering what role the federal government should have in education. What is your stance on education? Should there be a strict federal standard? And what role should the U.S. government play in paying for it?
Thank you, Beth. Well, Beth, I can tell you I've heard a whole lot about the Common Core, and I've heard a whole lot about testing that goes on in schools. You know, my daughter-in-law, Tanya, is an eighth-grade teacher at MG School in Belleville. Now, of course, being an eighth-grade teacher means she's going to go immediately to heaven. But the problem that we have in our schools today is there's far too much teaching to the test.
We're not teaching kids critical thinking skills. We're teaching them to take tests. Well, you can take a test and be good at taking tests, but all that proves is that you're good at taking tests. It doesn't prove that you're educated or that you're good at critical thinking skills. And I've heard that same complaint from teachers and from school administrators and from parents as I've gone around the district meeting with people. You know, as I talk to employers, what employers want skilled, trained folks who have the ability to divide 3/8 by 2 and have the ability to master skills. You know, when I was at Southwestern Illinois College up at Granite City campus a couple of weeks ago and met with a young lady named Dawn. Dawn had been working as a housekeeper in a hotel. Minimum wage, couldn't get 40 hours a week, 2 kids at home, food stamps, couldn't support the kids, didn't have the money to put gas in the car at the end of the week. But what she did, she went to SWEC and took a course in welding. And today, she is working as a robotic welder, operating this incredible machinery, making a good middle-class wage, and with a great fringe benefit package. She's got health insurance, she's got a retirement plan, and that's what she has done through obtaining the training. I think I have sponsored the Jobs Act and the Work Act, both of which focus on those kinds of training, both of which work with community colleges. You know, we have great community colleges here in our district.
Time, Representative Bost, your response.
Thank you. Whether it's Common Core or No Child Left Behind, I've always been a big believer that the federal government should not be involved at this level for our education. It should be pass-through funds that should be handled at the state and local level. Who better knows how to educate our children? Who better knows the unique situations that each school district faces than our local schools and our states? You know, I know that there's this great big dream of building this big government that will come in and take care of education. You can't paint it with that broad of brush. And that's the problem, and I believe that it should be controlled at the state and local level.
Candidate Bradshaw.
That's probably why the state of Illinois is in such deep debt, the belief that we're not going to take any federal money to help us out. I can tell you the unique situation of a lot of our local schools. They're starved for funds. They're laying off teachers. They're cutting programs. Teachers are having to go reach into their own pockets to buy supplies for the kids. This is untenable. I think that the federal government should indeed put some funds into the schools. Common Core, on the other hand, although, again, it sounds like a great idea, there should be, a common set of things that every child in America knows, how to read, how to write, some history, some civics would be nice. But, of course, Common Core is not about that, really. It's about selling tests and teaching to the test, and the teachers don't like it, the kids don't like it. It turns all of these teach-to-the-test kind of things are turning schools into cheats and liars. We never had this kind of widespread cheating before until the federal government stepped in and said, "Well, you people have to, you kids have to get better and better and better every year. So what are they going to do? Or lose their funding? They lie." I think that's an atrocity-producing situation, and it should stop. We need to get teachers together with administrators and parents and figure out a better way to teach our children. And I really think that school should be about helping every child reach their full potential in whatever teaching method works best for them. And I don't really think of schools, I don't think schools should be just places where they turn out little robots for employers' benefit.
Molly Parker has a question for Representative Bost.
Representative Bost, this question comes from a reader of the Southern Illinoisan, Ms. Lynn Wolf. Republicans in the U.S. House have repeatedly voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act known as Obamacare. To this point, the effort has stalled in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Do you support the act, and what action do you think is needed if you are elected?
Well, first off, let me tell you, when elected, I'll only be one of 435. So you will try to have to work within the confines of working with those on both sides of the aisle to try to come up with a sensible plan. Let me first off tell you that the idea of Obamacare having health care that's affordable, portable, and dealing with pre-existing conditions is a good idea. The problem is the system failed tremendously. Now the question is, do we want to repeal and replace or have small changes to try to correct what's already been put in place? Let me tell you that there's about 60 bills, and about 10 of them have been placed over that were repealed. And it's about 60 total, like I said, that have some kind of modification or change. They're laying on Harry Reid's desk. Our congressman chose to only vote for one of those, and it was where we delayed the implementation on business. Folks, let me tell you that I do believe right now that what the president is doing as far as holding a bill and changing a bill after the fact without taking it to Congress is not right. I don't think it's in his power. I think he's overstepped his power. But that being said, we must make sure that we work together to find a solution and quit the gridlock on the... there's bills over there. You just said that. The Senate has to take these bills up to try to cure the problem before it negatively impacts businesses come January 1 and individuals come January 1 whenever it is not affordable, when it is not available, and with all the problems of a bill that's, when you put the regulations and everything with it, 9 foot tall.
Paula Bradshaw's next.
Obamacare is another example of using what the American people want to screw them over. Just like No Child Left Behind, everyone wants education for their children, everyone wants health care. But Obamacare was never about providing health care for the people of America. It was about providing subsidies and giveaways to the insurance companies. If America really wanted to provide health care to the people of America, they would train more doctors and open more clinics and make sure that the public health system, it was healthy, that our water stayed clean. We would never, ever think of fracking because that would be an outrage to public health. We would give up coal because that causes so much asthma in children and older people. So if we really wanted to care, if we really cared about public health, we would make a healthy country, and we would train more doctors and open more clinics. Kind of interesting, one of the first things of Obamacare that was actually implemented was $50 billion to force every hospital and every doctor's office in this country to go to computer records. And let me tell you, they had to drag us kicking and screaming because it's so inefficient and it's so ineffective. And I note that the reason that the hospital in Houston didn't, or Dallas didn't catch the Ebola victim is because the nursing computer program didn't connect to the doctor's computer program. So even though the nurse put in that the man had been to Liberia, the doctor didn't see it because he wasn't on that screen. And that's Obamacare for you. Thank you very much. It was a big boondoggle both to the health insurance companies and the computer program people.
Representative Inyart.
Thank you, Jack. I need to back up 1 second. I need to say, I think I heard Mr. Boss say that I lied when I said that he endorsed the Paul Ryan budget. But I was in my barbershop, Bovine's Barbershop on East Main Street in Belleville a couple of weeks ago, and they handed me a brochure. Mike, you may remember that brochure. You left it in my barbershop. And one of my campaign staff out in the audience has that brochure. And on the back page, the very back of that folder, it says, number one, that I would vote for the Paul Ryan budget, and number two, it says I would vote to repeal the ACA or Obamacare. Well, let me tell you, I was not in Congress when Obamacare or the ACA was adopted. However, we have taken, I think it's 56 votes, I'm not sure I lost count, but virtually all of those votes were to repeal Obamacare in one way or another, or the ACA one way or another. And Mike is wrong, it wasn't one that I voted for, there were a few. When the administration was wrong, when the ACA needed to be corrected, I voted to correct it. And that's what we need to do. You know, first of all, there are some provisions in there that are really, really beneficial to folks. For example, you can keep your child on your own health insurance until that child is 26. I've got a very good friend whose wife had cancer about 10 years ago, nearly died.
but she recovered. Now, she would not be insurable today if it weren't for that Obamacare. You know, how about a child who gets terribly ill as a child? Back in the bad old days, there was a lifetime cap on what could be spent on health insurance. That cap has been eliminated because of the ACA. So if you have a child who has a terrible disease at an early age, or you have a spouse who might get cancer and be required to go through incredible amounts of treatment, I've got a red card. I have to stop. Thank you.
Next question is from Jennifer Fuller for Paula Bradshaw.
Ms. Bradshaw, the Department of Veterans Affairs has been widely criticized for secret waiting lists at hospitals all over the nation. We're just a few miles from the local VA hospital here in Marion, which has had its share of problems. What confidence do you have that the new leadership is taking appropriate steps to clean up the VA, and what further changes would you make?
Well, actually, that kind of ties into the last question, which when I was talking about public health and training more doctors and opening up clinics, I also should have mentioned that the Green Party also calls for Medicare for all, which would simply, instead of having a 700-page bill, Obamacare, you would simply amend the Medicare Act to take away the age limit of 65. That would solve the problem of the age limit. That would solve the problem of pre-existing conditions. That would solve the problem of, expensive health care conditions, and it would also solve the problem of the Veterans Administration. If you had one single source of Medicare in this country and everybody was entitled to it, you wouldn't have to have this hodgepodge of healthcare providers. As far as the waiting lists, we have waiting lists in private care too. My mom was told that she might have lung cancer and she needed to see a pulmonologist, and they gave her an appointment 4 months down the road because there were no appointments earlier than that. So for 4 months, she believed that she had lung cancer. And we're supposed to believe this is the best healthcare system in the world? I mean, clearly we need more doctors, we need more clinics, and we just need more healthcare providers, as well as a single-payer healthcare insurance.
Representative N, your response, please.
Thank you, Jack. You know, once again, I'm going to ask you to look at promises and performance. Now, immediately after I was elected, before I was even sworn into office, I was sworn in on January 3rd of last year, I went to the Marion VA Hospital. I went there in December, and I went there for one reason, because I learned when I was a young NCO and I was a young officer that what gets inspected gets fixed. Congress has oversight authority over the VA, and we have to inspect it. We have to exercise that responsibility. So even before I was sworn in, I went there. I didn't talk to just administrators. I talked to veterans, I talked to frontline staff, and I talked to administrators to see what was going on. I have been back. I have been to VA clinics, the outpatient clinics in Mount Vernon, in Belleville. I have been all around talking to veterans to ensure that things get fixed. I sponsored a bill which would require the Veterans Administration to make a determination on veterans' disability claims within 120 days. And if that decision wasn't made within 120 days, the veteran would be presumed to be disabled and receive those benefits. Guess what? By my merely introducing that bill and pushing that legislation, the Veterans Administration has reduced the backlog of disability claims by 40%. I want you to compare that, though, to Mr. Bost's record. Mr. Bost refused to vote for a bill that would have increased veterans' beds in Illinois veterans' homes, refused to vote for that bill. Oh, by the way, he refused to vote for that bill, but he did vote to raise his pay by 9.6%. He also...
Time. Representative Bost.
Thank you, Jack. Back to the question. Let me tell you that it is important to make sure that our veterans are provided for. And I have stood for veterans in all of my time in the state of Illinois, and I'll continue to do that when elected to serve in Washington. Let me also say that it's also important to keep in touch
And I would visit the veterans' home as well, but I'd have town hall meetings about it when something starts going south. Mr. Henry didn't do that. You had a town hall meeting after I put one together, and that would be your first town hall meeting. It was a tele-town hall meeting. But that being said, let me tell you when that vote that you claim against veterans occurred. It was Rod Blagojevich's budget. You remember him. He's the one who made you a general.
Okay. Let's hold the applause. Hold the applause till the end. Thank you very much. Next question is from Beth Hunsdorfer for Representative Inyer.
Congressman, according to Experian, a credit reporting bureau, students across the country owe $1.2 trillion in student loan debt. This is an 84% increase since 2008. The report says that 40 million Americans have at least one open student loan, and on average, they owe $29,000. This tremendous debt on the younger generation may influence their decision to buy a home or a car. Does the federal government have any responsibility to address this debt or the rising cost of college tuition?
Thank you, Beth. Before I answer your question, I do have to spend about 10 seconds correcting Mr. Boss's misapprehension. You see, Governor Blagojevich did not make me a general. I went to the U.S. Army War College, was selected by a board of active duty officers to serve as a brigadier general, and was promoted. I was nominated to the United States Senate by a fellow by the name of George W. Bush. And was serving as the commander of the land component, that is the Army National Guard of the state of Illinois. When my predecessor retired, I was tabbed to succeed him and was subsequently promoted to Major General by action of a board of active duty Army officers and again nominated by George W. Bush. Now, to your question, Beth, student loans. Student loans are an incredible drag on the economy. When young people graduate from school, and you know that's part of the problem we have with the VA. Doctors who graduate with hundreds of thousands of dollars in indebtedness can't afford to come down to Marion, Illinois and work for the VA hospital for federal government wages. Instead, they decide to stay in Chicago or in New York or in St. Louis, where they can earn a much bigger paycheck to pay back those student loans. Now, one of the things that I support and that I have co-sponsored is a bill, and in fact it's passed, that would limit the interest on student loans to just over 8%. There was no such interest provision. And, you know, let's talk about the Paul Ryan budget one more time. The Paul Ryan budget would have allowed the banks to charge any amount they want on those student loans, even though the bank has zero risk because they're guaranteed by the federal government. So let's get the, you know, you could go buy a house and borrow money for between 3% and 4%. You can, I saw the credit union had an ad up on their website the other day where you could borrow money to buy a car for 1.8%. Well, why should students, excuse me.
Thank you very much. Representative Bost.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. According to Experian, a credit reporting bureau, students across the country owe $1.2 trillion, which is an 84% increase since 2008. The report says 40 million Americans have at least one open student loan and on average owe $29,000. This tremendous debt on a younger generation may influence their decision to buy a home or a car. Does the federal government have any responsibility to address this debt or the rising cost of college tuition?
Yes, let me tell you that the bill that that Congressman Inyer spoke about makes sense. Something that will allow them the opportunity, and we would agree on that issue, to make sure that they can afford these loans and continue to work and take a longer time to pay it back or whatever, so that they can have that opportunity to continue to work. So.
Paula Bradshaw.
Well, I was kind of interested in you saying you'd like to meet with your constituents in these town hall meetings. Is that like when you demanded 12 debates and said that you wanted everyone to have the ability to hear you speak 12 times, and when it came to the first debate, you were just too busy to come? I guess so. As far as student debt goes, I don't think that teenagers should be put into debt for the rest of their lives in a desperate attempt to get a education that will get them a job with a living wage. Everybody that works deserves a living wage, and I think that the children shouldn't get into debt at all to go to school. We should have free college tuition for every qualified student that wants to go to college. And that should be free and available to any qualified student, like I said. But for children or teenagers or people that don't want to go to college, that doesn't mean that they should have to live at substandard wages for the rest of their lives. You know, these college degrees being sold as a ticket out of poverty, and 40% of our people are now living at or near poverty. This is ridiculous. They can't all go to welding school and get good jobs. That leaves a whole lot of people behind. And I don't just want just no child left behind. I want no worker left behind. I think that everyone should have a living wage, as I said, and college should be free to all qualified students, and vocational school too. If someone's good at welding or repairing cars or whatever their passion is, then I think they should be able to go to vocational school for free. And we ought to be able to, if we had a publicly controlled, non-debt-based money supply, they could spend into the economy money for valuable, worthwhile things like education and health.
Next question is from Molly Parker to Representative Bost.
Representative Bost, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has proposed new rules for carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants, among other plans to curb greenhouse gas production. Do you support these? Many coal mines and power plants stand to lose substantially in this. How would you protect those workers in Southern Illinois while balancing the need for a cleaner environment?
Well, let me tell you that serving on the coal boards here in the state of Illinois, working in the environment and energy side, working side by side with people that own and work in coal mines, United Mine Workers, to try to make sure that we are able to continue to mine our coal and use our coal. The EPA came up with these regulations that could devastate. And let me tell you that working in the Public Utilities Committee, that we know that 42% of our energy in the state of Illinois comes from coal-burning power plants. Only one of them burns Illinois coal, unfortunately. But 42%. The rest is nukes, some gas, and only 6%. And I'd love to see it more than that, but only 6% comes from solar and wind. But that being said, we can't just all of a sudden throw the switch and walk away from our coal. We can't, nor should we, because it can be used and used here in this United States wisely. Right now, we're shipping overseas. I'm glad that we've got those jobs. I'm glad that we're actually being able to mine our coal. But if those EPA rules had they went into place, it could have devastated us. The reality is there was a bill that did stop it. It was sent to Reed's desk again. It's still laying there. But unfortunately, our current congressman didn't vote on that. However, he did come back after the courts said that it stopped, that he really didn't want it to do that all along. Well, that's not the way he voted.
Paula Bradshaw.
What the coal industry is doing is pitting the interests of the miners, or the coal mine owners, actually, against the interests of farmers who have to deal with the global warming effects, against the interests of the wineries and the tourists in Southern Illinois, against the interests of the children with asthma and the people who have brain damage from mercury poisoning. This is pitting the interests of a very small group of mine owners against the rest of the people in America and the world, because the effects of global climate change go all over the world, where you have droughts and wildfires and floods and hurricanes, and many, many people suffer. So you say we can't flip the switch? Yes, we can. I mean, if the money that we spent on fossil fuel subsidies and war, if we could turn it into renewable energy, switching our infrastructure, we could do it very, very quickly. We can mobilize very quickly when we want to. America is known for being able to, you know, roll out the new industries in a very small amount of time. Just because 40% of our energy comes from coal now doesn't mean that it always has to. That's illogical. That's an illogical conclusion. You can draw a much more rational conclusion in that, yes, our energy comes from coal. Yes, coal is harmful to miners, the environment, children, the oceans, the climate. Therefore, we can switch because we know with a combination of energy conservation and renewable energy, we could go totally renewable in a very fast period of time. So carbon emissions are just, they're a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. You know, they weren't going to do any good anyhow. We need to get off of coal and other fossil fuels and on to renewables.
Representative Inyart.
Thank you, Jack. I need to back up to student loans for 1 second, and I need to point out that State Representative Bost voted against a Community College Act which would have provided grants to graduates of those community colleges who had a 3.0 average or better to attend state universities here in the state of Illinois. So I think folks need to ask Mr. Bost about why he voted against that act to provide these great students with scholarships to attend state schools. Now, moving on to your question, promises, performance. Remember that, promises, performance. I promised that I would support Illinois' coal industry when I ran for election, and today I serve as the co-chair of the Congressional Coal Caucus. Now, it's very unusual for a freshman legislator to serve as the chairman of a caucus, but I serve as the co-chair with Republican John Shimkus, also from Illinois, a bipartisan chairman of the coal caucus. Now, why do I serve on that coal caucus? Because 40% of our electric power is generated via coal. You know, we need a balanced approach here. Everybody agrees we want our kids to breathe clean air. We want our kids to drink clean water. What we have to do is we have to achieve our energy needs in a balanced manner. We can't turn off those coal plants tomorrow. We can't turn them off in 2 years. I met with the EPA administrator and got her to agree to extend the comment on these proposed regulations. And remember, they're just proposed regulations. You still have the opportunity to comment. I ask you, send my office your comments. I will ensure that every one of those comments from the voters in Illinois 12 get to the EPA so the EPA knows how we feel about it.
I'm for it.
I am the only candidate up here who's been endorsed by the United Mine Workers.
Representative, thank you very much. Okay, thank you all out there. Jennifer Fuller has a question, first going to Paula Bradshaw.
Ms. Bradshaw, hydraulic fracturing has become a hotly debated issue in several parts of the country, including here in southern Illinois. Do you support this oil and gas extraction process, and should there be federal standards to govern it similar to those in place for coal? And if so, what changes would you make?
I don't support it. I think the regulations are ridiculous. You can't control what happens a mile under the ground. What they're doing with fracking is they're taking clean, fresh water that all life on Earth depends, and they're mixing it with poisonous chemicals. Then they inject it into the ground at high pressure so that it fractures the shale upon which we are living, causing earthquakes. And it releases the gas, which is highly radioactive, as well as being bad for greenhouse gases, for global warming. So I don't see what regulations could possibly take away the danger of earthquakes, water contamination, air contamination, and climate change. That's another thing that is meaningless. So no, I do not support fracking. I support renewable energy, like I said, and we can switch to renewable energy very quickly. I don't know why people think we can go bomb Syria within a week. There's no money spared on that. But when it comes to protecting our own people here at home, then we don't have the money for that. No, we don't have the money for renewable energy. We have to frack. We don't have the money for renewable energy. We have to burn coal. So I think that we should have our priorities straight. And instead of spending $50 billion to go bomb other people, we should spend $50 billion to switch to renewable energy here at home.
Representative Inyart, your response, please.
Thank you, Jack. You know, I have read a couple of studies on fracking, and what I have read indicates that if, biggest two-letter word in the English language, if the proper engineering is used, if the proper safety precautions are used, if the proper regulations are followed, it can be safe. Now, Illinois has the strictest legislation in the nation. Of any of the 50 states in the nation, Illinois has the strictest. It has the best law in the nation. Why does it have the best law? It has the best law because Representative John Bradley from right here in Marion put all the players in a room. You know, the producers, the Sierra Club, other environmental groups, the regulators, put everybody in a room, and they worked out a compromise solution. Now, nobody got everything they wanted, but you know what? There is no free lunch. No matter what energy source we use, whether we use oil, whether we use solar, whether we use wind, nuclear, you pick a type of energy source, you pay a price. And we must ensure that if we're going to frack, that we have solid environmental regulations. Now, there are some folks on the stage who don't like regulations, but let me tell you, remember Murray Energy? That was the coal company out in West Virginia where all those dozens of miners got killed. Why did they get killed? Well, afterwards it was found that Murray Energy had violated hundreds of times the safety regulations in force. So we need to have the proper regulation, not unduly burdensome, but remember BP Oil in the Gulf of Mexico violated safety regulations. Let's ensure that the regulations we have are tough, stringent, designed to protect people and the environment and lives, and then enforce them instead of failing.
Thank you very much. Representative Bost.
Thank you, Jack. And let me answer in the fact that the congressman on fracking here in the state of Illinois is correct on almost everything except for the fact that it was not just John Bradley in the room. It was Mike Bost and David Rice. And working together in a bipartisan manner, we put some of the toughest rules in place so that we can actually go after our natural resources in a safe manner, protecting our water, our groundwater, our surface water, also protecting the air, making sure that there are certain seismologist locations that we monitor. We monitor before the process starts and after the process begins and well after the process is over. We also have catch pools to make sure if there's any blowback, 110% of everything that goes in the ground is monitored. We also were able to convince and work with the business side because they have certain, let me tell you that less than 0.06% of what they use is more than anything and more than salt water and sand. But when they use those chemical compounds, which are similar to soap, those compounds are given to ID&R so that we can test the soil prior and the water prior and during and after. It is a very safe process. It is a sensible process, but the most important thing is it puts people to work. Income to the state from income tax from people working. Income to the state from sales tax from when the products that are bought and hauled and moved. And a severance tax that goes to the state of Illinois. Properly implemented and implemented quickly could help Illinois and its budget woes. I supported the bill, worked side by side in the bill, and a lot of not long negotiation in bipartisan manner to get a very successful and safe bill here in the state of Illinois. The governor needs to push forward to get it implemented.
Our next question is from Beth Hunsdorfer for Representative Inyart.
According to the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, Illinois added 272,500 jobs since February of 2010, the national low point for private sector jobs. There are still 65,900 more people unemployed in Illinois than when the recession began. What can the federal government do to ensure increased job growth? And please be as specific as you can.
Certainly. You know, the good news is that we have had 55 months now of straight economic growth. And the good news is that the recession has been easing. The good news is that Wall Street has recovered. The bad news is that Main Street has not recovered. You know, we've seen new records set daily on Wall Street. We've not seen new records set on Main Street. Now, to address the unemployment question, and it's interesting, I was in Mount Vernon last week, and Mary Jane Chesley proudly shoved the Mount Vernon paper in front of me and said, look at this, and unemployment had dropped 1.5% over a year ago in Mount Vernon. And Beth, the Belleville News Democrat, last week had an article, St. Clair County unemployment had dropped 2%. The problem is that not all of that growth is happening throughout the district. Where the growth is happening, where jobs are growing and booming, are in areas where we have good transportation infrastructure. The Metro East area, if you look at the area by 270, 255, those warehouses are booming. If you look at Mount Vernon, Mayor Chesley will tell you about her 2 interstate highways, 4 Class A rail lines. We've got the infrastructure there, so those jobs are booming. What we need to do in those areas where it is not booming, you look at the other counties along the river, much less infrastructure. We need to develop that transportation infrastructure. The second thing we need to do is we need to provide the training and the skills upgrade for workers. We need to, which is why I sponsored the Work Act and the Jobs Act. And what those do is focus on providing training for unemployed and underemployed folks, provides a scholarship for unemployed folks for up to 2 years, up to $2,000 per year, in order for them to get the training at the local community colleges to put them to work.
Representative Boss, your response.
Thank you. I think that this would be a good time to actually go to a story about, I was talking to a congressman the other day, and he said that he had an Olympic swimmer that came to him and says, you know, what's the problem with jobs, and why is it we can't get growth, and why are the problems the way they are? And he explained it this way. Well, right after the Second World War, if you were the Olympic swimmer and you were in a swimming competition and all of a sudden you finished 2 lengths ahead, for some reason we decided that that's not fair. So let's put a 5-pound weight around your waist and we'll call it regulation. And then I tell you what, we made the race again. And now you weren't quite a 2 lengths ahead. You're only 1 length ahead. But, you know, that's not fair either. So let's put more regulation. Let's go 10 pounds on you and drag you down. And then, we were almost tied, but that just wasn't enough. Well, finally, over so many years, ladies and gentlemen, our federal government, through the EPA and other rules and regulations, have placed such regulations on us that we can't compete in a worldwide market. I say it's time to shed the weight belt and actually start putting people to work. I want to make sure everything's safe. But I don't want to put myself in a situation where my children and grandchildren can't continue to work and provide a living for themselves here in this United States. And that's the issue that needs to be dealt with. It needs to be dealt with honestly, straightforward, and make sure that we remove that belt so that our jobs can compete in a worldwide market and we can put people to work and become self-sufficient again.
Ms. Bradshaw.
Well, the reason the United States was ahead after World War II is because all other industrialized countries in this world were bombed into rubble. So, of course, we did better after World War II. As a matter of fact, in the 50s, the average corporate share of the federal tax revenues was 28%. Now it's down to 10%, and they're screaming that that's too much for them. Well, in the prosperous 50s, they paid 28% of federal funds, and the top tax rate on the very rich was in the 90 percentile. So I don't think you can say that high taxes and regulations are what brought this country down. Let's go a little bit further back in history. Let's go back to the 19th century when this country was being industrialized and workers were dying like flies. On the railroads, they died. In the mines, they died. In factories, they died. In the mills, they died. And they fought for regulations. What regulations are laws for corporations. They're laws that keep them from killing people. They're laws that keep them from ripping off consumers. They're laws that keep them from destroying our environment. And workers died. You know, they were shot down in the streets by the Rockefellers and such for protesting for an end to the slaughter of workers in this country. At one time in Pittsburgh, there was one-third of all working men between the ages of 18 and 70 who were dead because of the steel mills. So I don't think we want to give up regulations. As Representative Inyer pointed out, Murray Energy just ignored regulations and a bunch of miners died. Deepwater Horizon ignored regulation and a bunch of miners died. People didn't like it when the Chinese pet food killed their dogs. Well, that's what regulations protect you from. People don't like it when your rivers can catch on fire. That's what regulations protect you from. What we need is a Green New Deal to put people to work with a publicly controlled money supply that will do it without going into debt. That's what we need to put people to work.
Next question is from Molly Parker for Representative Bost.
Representative Bost, in this election, much has been made of temperament. Tell me how your personality will or has exhibited itself as a congressman.
Let me tell you. I got to start out and say that as I noticed these ads, it's amazing that it says that I do that all the time, but yet I'm only wearing two ties. And my wife said she knows she bought me more ties than that in all the years I've been in the General Assembly. So, you know, I need to explain that maybe, just maybe, there are times when we need our legislators to stand up for us. And let me tell you that if someone violates your rights under the Constitution or the rights of the people on the House floor in Springfield or on the House floor in Washington or in committee, then that needs to be stand up. They need to stand up for you. They need to stand up for you. That's what they're sent there to do. Or if they have rules that make it to where your representative or any other representative doesn't have equal time and the opportunity to represent the people to the right that they need to be represented, then that's a time when you need your legislator to stand up. When the issue that everybody puts on this news media or on these ads went on the internet, we got called from 50 states and 6 foreign countries in our office telling us that's the way I feel about my government. That's the way I feel about my government because nobody's standing up for us. Now, does that mean you go out and yell every time or that you do? But let me tell you, the bill that I stood up and argued about so passionately failed. That bill would have taken the pension debt and shifted it to every property tax owner in this room. Everyone. It was done in the middle of the night. It was a 198-page bill. Was I angry? You bet. And then with things that are happening in Washington, you ought to be angry too. And if you want somebody to just sit around and do nothing.
Paula Bradshaw's next.
I don't understand why a temper tantrum would get support from all over the country. I mean, I guess you could say that it shows passion, but if a 2-year-old throws himself on the floor and kicks because they want something, that shows passion too, but you wouldn't send them to Congress. It reminds me of people that bring in their kids and their kids kick me or hit me or something, and they look all proud and they go, "Boys will be boys." No, boys don't have to act like that. Your kid's a brat. And the reason he's a brat is because you let him get away with it. And I don't think we should, I think that Congress should be a place of dignity where people go and they have respect for the office, they have respect for the Constitution. And I think it's kind of interesting to talk about respect for the Constitution when neither of my opponents seem to realize that in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, it says that only Congress shall declare war and raise the armies and appropriate the funds for war. And I believe it was you who was quoted as saying that if Obama went to Congress to start bombing Syria, Iraq, or wherever he's going to bomb this week, that you thought it was political posturing and not the duty of the Constitution. So I think that you should send people to Congress that actually know what the Constitution stands for, knows the duties of Congress, and would not allow a president to take you into 8 wars without paying for them, putting them on the national credit card, running the country into trillions of dollars of debt, and then telling people, oh, we have to cut health and education because we are so much in debt. Well, you're in debt because you are spending trillions of dollars on war and you're not paying for it. And that's Congress's duty as well as to declare war. As far as bragging about the strictest regulations in the country, remember that John Bradley and the rest of them, they bragged about the strictest regulations in the country and then turned around and hassled DNR about those very regulations that they brag about.
Representative Inyard.
Thank you, Jack. Remember in my opening when I talked about walking in the footsteps of giants. Think about it, Jerry Costello, Glenn Pichard, Kenny Gray, Paul Simon. I think I try to emulate their temperament. Let me tell you, I spent 35 and a half years in the military, and in all of the jobs that I held, going from a basic trainee to being a two-star general, you were given a mission, you were given certain resources, and you were expected to get the mission done. Get her done. That is the motto that I took with me to Washington, D.C. It's a little bit different job there, because there you have to allocate the resources. You have to weigh between different competing priorities. You know, in some ways, maybe it's like fighting a flood. Because I'll tell you, when you're fighting a flood and you take a sandbag and you hand it up to that next person in line, you don't ask that person, are you a Republican? And the person you took the sandbag from doesn't ask you, are you a Democrat? What you're doing is working together as a team to get a job done. You know, one of my commercials has a line in it where I say, you don't lead by shouting, you lead by example. And that's what I learned over 35 years of being in the military. You know, I think I've done that. For example, I made the announcement several weeks ago about two new cyber squadrons, cyber squadron warriors coming to Scott Air Force Base, 322 military positions. That's going to help generate the $3 billion a year that Scott Air Force Base provides our economy. And who better than someone already serving on the Armed Services Committee who has spent all that time in the military to help protect Scott Air Force Base and grow Scott Air Force Base. I saved over $500 million over 10 years out of the Defense Department budget alone.
Thank you. Next question is from Jennifer Fuller for Paula Bradshaw.
Political rancor has made headlines from Washington to Springfield, even to our local communities. In the interest of getting along, please tell us one positive attribute about your fellow candidates.
Nice tie, Mike. And thank you for calling for fair taxes.
Absolutely. Glad to do it. Oh.
You have a little more time?
Oh, well, then I can go back to full employment. bragging about the unemployment rate coming down a little bit. Now, the Humphrey-Hawkins Act, Full Employment Act of 1978, said that if unemployment in this country goes above 3%, that the so-called job creators or private sector, or as they used to call them, the robber barons, don't provide the jobs, then the federal government comes in and directly provides jobs at living wages to people who need work. And they can be put to work doing socially necessary labor, like building renewable energy, building sustainable transportation, refurbishing housing, insulating uninsulated houses, all the things that we need to save energy and provide energy so that we aren't dependent on coal or gas or foreign oil, because that just leads us down the path to more global warming, to more pollution, and to more wars. So I say that what we need is a Green New Deal. We can base it on the Humphrey-Hawkins Act, which Paul Simon, by the way, voted for when he was in Congress. And that is what we need to do. We need to start obeying the law.
Representative Enyard, what would you like to say about your opponents?
Well, thank you, Jack. And Paula, as I said in my opening, I really appreciate all of your years of service. As an ER nurse, I think you've done a marvelous job in helping care for patients. And Paula, your passion for the environment is certainly matched by no one in the 12th Congressional District. You voice your concerns, and you are very upfront about it, and you don't hesitate to tell people your beliefs. And so I congratulate you on that. Mike, in terms of, I want to congratulate Mike. I'll tell you, a couple of months ago, he was on the radio show, and I heard him say that he was quarreling with Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, couldn't get anything done, the Democrats controlled it, he couldn't get anything done.
So when Republican Senator Dave Luchtefeld had a bill pending to help the levees at Grand Tower, I was concerned about that because I knew it had to get through the House. And Mike was carrying the bill for Senator Luchtefeld. So I came back from Washington, D.C., to testify in favor of that bill in front of a democratically controlled committee because I wanted them to know how important this bill was for all of the residents of Southern Illinois. And Mike Bost, even though he was running against me for Congress, had the courtesy to show up at a press conference that we had at the Capitol in Springfield and thank me for coming back to testify to ensure that that bill, which assisted folks in Southern Illinois, got through the General Assembly. So, Mike, thank you for that courtesy. I appreciate it.
Representative Bost.
First off, let me say that, Paul, just for running for office and being involved and bringing your views forward, I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate, Bill, your service in the military. And I also appreciate the fact that you did come to Springfield, and I appreciate that. Now, I do appreciate you also using the line I used in the paper a while ago, that you don't care whether somebody's stacking a sandbag, whether they're handing it to you, whether they're Republican or Democrat. I first used that in the newspaper, and I appreciate you using it up here as well. I tell you what, you coming there, I appreciate that. They hadn't seen that very often, that a congressman does come. I appreciate that.
All right, thanks very much. Next question is from Beth Hunsdorfer for Bill Inyart.
Who would you like to see run for president in 2016 and why?
Paula Bradshaw. Who would I like to see run for president or who I think will run for president? I think that we need someone running for president who has experience in foreign affairs. The state of the world is really very, very dangerous. In my many years of military service, I cannot remember a time when the world stage was more dangerous. You know, and certainly the problem with ISIS and ISIL in the Middle East is gathering a lot of headlines, and it's clearly a potential problem. But I don't think we can forget about Russia. You know, really, and I was speaking to the United Nations Association last night in Carbondale, and one of the things that I talked about was the Ukraine, because they're really, when you look at existential threats, and by an existential threat, I mean a threat that would destroy the United States of America as we know it. There's really only one, and those are the Russian ICBMs. North Korea's got a few missiles and so on, and there are certainly some folks who can do us a lot of damage, but only one nation could destroy us, and that's Russia. So the adventurism that President Putin is showing in Ukraine, the fact that they're sending in Russian troops, and is clearly of great concern. Something that hasn't been talked about with the ISIL situation, really, is the fact that they're now right on the borders of Turkey. Turkey, of course, is a member of NATO. And with NATO, we have what are called Article 6 pledges. An attack on any one NATO member is an attack on all of us, and we are all required to defend that NATO member. So if Turkey is attacked by ISIL, under the NATO treaty, we must defend Turkey or we are disavowing our treaty obligations. And much the same thing can happen in Central Europe. If the Russians continue encroaching, Ukraine is not NATO, but Poland is.
Thank you very much.
Lithuania is.
Representative Bost.
I don't have one name because I'm watching the candidates for who might come out. But let me tell you whether she or he, whatever they are and whoever they are, they need to be someone who can administrate and truly keep control of their administration. I think we've seen enough problems throughout administration, the administration we have right now. And I want whoever it is that is respected worldwide so that when they say there's a red line, it's a red line. And I want them to be a leader to a point that, because we're in a kind of a rough time right now. We and God bless him, I served in the military under Jimmy Carter and under Ronald Reagan. But Jimmy Carter, very nice man, but we were in lots of situations like we are right now. So we need that very strong, charismatic leader that can step up and take charge. I'm going to watch the field just like you will, and I don't have one that I'm picking yet.
Paula Bradshaw.
Well, last time we ran Jill Stein, and she's a very sane person. Jill Stein would never draw a red line 5,000 miles from our borders and right on the border of another country and tell them they can't stop over it. Jill Stein would not call it Russian aggression when what happened in Ukraine was Victoria Nuland, who is an assistant secretary of state, testified that the United States spent $5 billion that we could have used here at home to overthrow the elected government of Ukraine, which they did do. And then she picked the new prime minister, Yats. She called him Yats, who was put in. And then they had a fake election in which a bunch of open fascists were put into the government in Kiev, and they promptly started making threats against the Russians in eastern Ukraine, who the media insists on calling pro-Russian separatists. Well, they're not. They're Russians. They were only put into Ukraine in the 1920s. They're ethnic Russians. When the vote in Scotland was going on, you didn't hear them calling the Scottish people pro-Scottish separatists. They were called Scottish people. And these are Russians. And the fascists that the United States put into power and backed in Kiev started making it illegal for Russian to be spoke. They had the what they call the gas princess, who threatened to kill every Russian. So they were alarmed. What happened in eastern Ukraine is those people took up arms against the fascists in Kiev, and there's a civil war in which Russia has not been involved at all. The only thing that Russia did was accept 97% of the people of Ukraine who voted and said, we want to go back to Russia where we were until 1956. That's when Crimea was put into the Ukraine. They voted 97% to go back to Russia. Russia said, okay, if you call that Russian aggression, that, in my opinion, is paranoid schizophrenia.
Thank you very much. We have time for one more question, and the way we're going to do this is we'll have a one-minute response from everyone. The question comes from Molly Parker, first to Mike Bost.
Representative Bost, proposals for raising the minimum wage range from putting it to anywhere from $10.10 to $15 an hour. Do you favor any change to the federal minimum wage, and if so, what should it be?
I favor raising the amount of jobs. When you raise the amount of jobs, you'll raise the minimum wage. When you raise the amount of work that is available to people, the natural thing that occurs is a raising of the minimum wage. The best example of that is whenever Gillister and Mary Lee moved across the river into Chester, the unemployment rate fell to 2%, and you couldn't find a minimum wage job there. I'm for everyone's salary going up based on the amount of jobs that are available.
Paula Bradshaw.
Well, that's one thing the Green New Deal would do. It would put people to work at a living wage. I am supporting the minimum wage to be at least $15 an hour plus single-payer health care, because what this would do to a lot of people is push them off their Medicaid and make them start paying for the private health insurance. So I'm for raising the minimum wage and for single-payer health care. And I am also for a Green New Deal in which the federal government would directly employ people at living wages. And that would indeed put some competition into the market. That would indeed give workers a more level playing field. Because right now, with the 20 million unemployed people we have in this country, you can't talk about fair competition. The employers have all the advantages and the workers have none. They have to take whatever the job they get, no matter how dangerous, no matter how, you know, low paid, no matter how horrible it is.
Time. And Representative Inyart.
Thank you, Jack. I support raising the minimum wage, and I think that raising it to $10.10 an hour is certainly a good start. But the reason that I support that is because the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation. The minimum wage today is less, once you adjust for inflation, than it was when I was in high school. So unlike Social Security and veterans benefits and other types of programs,
Unemployment has not been indexed for inflation, and we need to keep pace with inflation. It's also wrong that people who are working 40 hours a week should still qualify for food stamps and other programs like that. We need to put their wages at a point where it has kept pace with inflation. And I would point out that my opponent, Mr. Bost, this is not his first time being opposed to minimum wage. Molly, he was quoted in your paper as being in favor of lowering the minimum wage in Illinois by $1 an hour.
Thank you, sir.
He voted against minimum wage, and he, while he was voting for increasing his own wages.
Time. Thank you very much. Time for closing statements. Let's move on. Representative Voss makes the first closing statement.
Thank you, Jack. I want to thank the Southern Illinoisan, the Belleville News Democrat, and WSIU for putting on this debate, the League of Women Voters. Folks, I've served the people of the 115th District well. I've worked hard for them. And it is a servant's position that I talked about before. I'm now asking for your vote for Congress of the United States, where I feel like we've been underserved. My opponent mentioned several legislators. He mentioned Paul Simon. He mentioned Glenn Beshard. And he mentioned Jerry Costello. And you know what? I know Jerry Costello, and he's no Jerry Costello. I'm going to tell you that Jerry Costello would keep in constant contact with his constituents and work hard for them and be a true servant. And I don't think we've got that right now. And I don't think that you're paying attention to what these issues are out here that affect us so much right here in Southern Illinois. I've served the people. I'm asking to serve the people at this capacity. I am proud of my record, even though sometimes it gets distorted in these debates. I've worked hard for the people. I've looked them in the eye, and I've worked in bipartisan manner. Let me tell you that a majority of my votes, when you put them together, whether it was Larry Willard or whether it was Brandon Phelps or John Bradley, you'll find that we work together as regions. We work together for Southern Illinois. And our votes quite often line up, instead of with our party, than with that at the local level. My opponent, on the other hand, has almost a 90% voting record with Nancy Pelosi. I don't think that's what Southern Illinois wants. Thank you. Thank you for having us here tonight.
Representative Inyard.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you to the sponsors for hosting this event. Remember when I opened, I asked you to think about promises and performance. Promises and performance. It's easy for a politician to make promises, measure the performance. You know, I promised that I would support Illinois' coal industry. I serve as the chair of the coal caucus with Republican John Shimkus. I have the endorsement, the only person up here who has the endorsement of the United Mine Workers. I've performed that promise. I promised that I would support the agriculture economy of our district. Agriculture feeds the world. You know, somebody said you may need a doctor once a year. You may need a lawyer once every 10 years. You need an undertaker once in your life. You need farmers three times a day. I have the endorsement, the only person up here who has the endorsement of the Illinois Farm Bureaus. I've received support from the Illinois Corn Growers and Soybean Association. I've supported education and training. That's why I have the endorsement of the Illinois Education Association and the Illinois Federation of Teachers. I've supported business. That's why I have the support of business groups like the Credit Unions of America. And I have fought for Social Security and to protect Medicare, and that's why I have the endorsement of the Alliance of Retired Americans. Mr. Bost, on the other hand, I've supported veterans, by the way. You heard about what I've done for veterans during the course of this debate. Mr. Bost, on the other hand, voted against veterans. He refused to vote for a bill that would have expanded beds at Illinois veterans' homes. He voted against the minimum wage increase to $5.50 an hour while he turned around and voted to raise his own pay 9.6%. Now, I don't know how many people in this audience or on the broadcast audience have received a 9.6% pay raise lately, but Mr. Vost voted for him to receive one. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Paula Bradshaw. Thank you, everyone. Paula.
It's time for a change. And I don't mean to change from one corporate politician to another corporate politician, a real change. The Republicans, after 34 years of corporate welfare and deregulation, when corporations have been on a massive crime spree with the bankers and the war criminals, they continue to insist that corporate welfare this time will trickle down on you. And the Democrats, they promise that they're for the workers, but they take the same corporate money and they have the same corporate agenda. It's time for a new Green New Deal, which would lead to a stable prosperity. Now, we've known for decades that we need to switch to renewable energy, and both of my opponents acknowledge that, but they don't, not yet. It reminds me of St. Augustine, who once said, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." That's how they are. We know that coal mining is dangerous to the environment. We know it's dangerous to people. We know it's dangerous to the miners. We know that global warming is a danger to everyone. We know that we can't afford to burn coal and oil anymore. We need the Green New Deal to switch to renewable energy and conservation, put people to work. There's absolutely no downside to the Green New Deal. It increases employment. It improves our environment. It gets us into peaceful cooperation with the rest of the people of the world, and it has a more equitable distribution of wealth right here at home. I would ask that people vote for their dreams and not their fears. I would ask that you vote for your hopes and not hate. I would ask that you would vote green.
That is the end of our first congressional debate of the 2014 general election. I'd like to thank the candidates, Representative Mike Bost of Murfreesboro, challenger Paula Bradshaw of Carbondale, and Representative Bill Enyart of Belleville. How about a hand for all the candidates? We also want to thank our panelists, Molly Parker of the Southern Illinoisan, Jennifer Fuller of WSIU Radio, and Beth Hunsdorfer of the Belleville News Democrat. Thanks also to the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, the Jackson County League of Women Voters, the staff of the Marion Cultural and Civic Center, as well as the Belleville News Democrat, and our partners, the Southern Illinois. And our second and final debate, our broadcast debates, will be on Wednesday, October 29th at 7 p.m. at Lindenwood University in Belleville. The debate will be streamed live at thesouthern.com and bnd.com. The debate will air on Friday, October 30th at 7 p.m. on WSIU Public Television. Thank you all, and good night from Marion.
Online support for this debate is made possible by WSIU Public Radio, a listener-supported service of Southern Illinois University, Carbondale.